Thank you, everybody. My name's Jim. I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank Billy for asking me to come and share a bit of my story. I've had this love-hate relationship with Zoom on so many levels. But this part of it, I really love. A lot of familiar faces here. Many of you have been to the derelicts meeting on Saturday midday, and it's just been a joy to get to know some of my sobriety brothers and sisters. There's so many of you. I'd only see you once or twice a year, and maybe exchange a handful of words and never really get to know you. And that has all changed as a result of Zoom. And the other thing I like about Zoom is I'm basically lazy. And my home group is an hour away from my house. And I've always been on the setup committee. I'm the key bearer. So I would leave my house at about 3 o'clock to get down for setup at 4:30. And then we do dinner. And then the meeting starts at 8. And if I was hosting the speaker, it would even start earlier. I'd have to go down and pick them up at the airport. And, and it was good for me to be inconvenienced to have to do those things. By the time I'd get home at night, I just felt like a different person. I felt like I had some sort of a purpose in life, which I never felt all the years I was drinking. And I loved to drink. I realized right away I was a short kid growing up. All my report cards, I even ran across a few of them not too long ago when my mother had passed away. The teachers had a habit of letting my parents know that I was very shy, I was very quiet. I'd probably get better grades if I participated. And my memory of school was I didn't want to be there. It seemed like all the other kids, just fit right in and were comfortable and laughing and playing together. And I just wanted to go home to my mom. And it was pretty much that way from the early days in school right up to high school. And I always had this sense of doom, no matter what I do, it's just going to turn out bad. And I really was faced with a dilemma in my teens, probably about 15, 14, 15, maybe 16. I was starting to notice the girls and I liked the girls. But they scared me. And a lot of my friends started dancing, asking the girls to dance at these dances and asking them out on dates. And early on in Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard Clancy I one time tell a story about being at a school dance and all the guys lined up on one side of the gymnasium and all the girls lined up on the other side of the gymnasium. And, and he picked out a girl that he was going to go ask to dance. And, and it took, everything he could muster up to walk across that gymnasium and ask this girl to dance. And so he got across the gymnasium, asked this girl to dance, and she said no. And he was crushed. He just turned around, walked back across that gym with his head hanging low, just feeling as low as he could be. And, and I identified with that. That was me. Other than I could never get the nerve to walk across the gym and ask a girl to dance because I knew what was going to happen. And, but then Clancy went on to tell a story where he went out into the parking lot and somebody had some booze in a brown paper bag and he took a couple of chugs off of that and went back into that dance and spotted that same girl across the gymnasium, walked across that floor with his head held high, asked her to dance, and she said no again. He said, but this time with the booze on board, it was different because instead of him reacting with this feeling of being a loser and walking back across that floor feeling sorry for himself, he felt sorry for her, and he walked back across that floor with his head held high, snapping his fingers, you know, and he just knew she was missing out on the best thing she could ever had. And, you know, and I never had that experience because I didn't know to go out and have a couple of belts, you know, and then go back in and start over. I hadn't got to that point, but I surely realized early on, in Alcoholics Anonymous that's what happens to me when I drink. It just changes everything. And that's what happened, you know, in my, early teens, not too long after that, I'd been sitting around thinking, you know, I'm going to just be a lonely guy the rest of my life. You know, I can't talk to the women. They scare me. Now that fear, I should have paid more attention to that fear because, you know, there was something to that. And, if I had paid more attention to that fear of women, it probably would have saved me a lot of heartache later on down the road. But at the time, you know, I'm just going to live a long and lonely life. And, but then once I started drinking, that all changed. And my first time drinking, it was a bunch of friends where they had somebody who was going to go down to the liquor store and buy a bunch of booze, and they were taking our orders. And my parents drank vodka, and that was the only thing I knew. So I ordered a bottle of vodka, and the guy came back and handed it to me. And you know, and I didn't know what vodka was. I didn't know what any of it was. And I popped the cap, and I took a little smell, big mistake. And I'd spent a little time in the hospital when I was young, and it smelled just like a hospital. And I thought, I'm not going to be able to drink this. And then everybody else was starting to chug it. And so I just held my nose, and I just chugged the whole thing. And it pretty much set the stage for my drinking for the next 25 years. I'm a chugger. I'm a puker. I'm a blackout drinker. I wake up the next day, I have no idea what happened the night before, and feeling horrible, swearing I will never do that again. But from that point on, there was just something about what happened that night and many nights there to follow, where I just couldn't wait to do it again. Even knowing, you know, what was going to happen, I couldn't wait to do it again. And I ended up, you know, just mostly partying in high school and, you know, weekends. Wasn't really a daily drinker. You know, did a lot of other stuff along the way. You know, I just wanted to fit in. And the more I drank, the more I wanted to fit in. And it was during the Vietnam era. We were talking about it earlier. They had the draft going on. They'd come out with this lottery at the time. They were still drafting, but it was in a lottery. And so I got my number, and it was number 84. And as it turned out, they were drafting people up to the 200 or 300. So I knew I was going to get drafted. You know, people started telling me if I wait and get drafted, I'm going straight to Vietnam. And so I made the first of many bad decisions. I decided I'm going to enlist for the draft, and hopefully that'll keep me out of Vietnam. And it did. You know, they made a lot of promises there. I was supposed to get the career that I wanted, supposed to go to where I wanted. I chose Hawaii and a few other perks. I was on a buddy plan. From the day we got on the bus there in Oakland, never saw my buddy again for 3 years. They sent me to Germany instead of Hawaii, which, you know, was better in Vietnam, but they sent me to Germany. And I did get the trade I wanted to get into, electrical engineering. And Germany turned out to be a good place for a guy like me because, you know, they got lots of good stuff to drink. I mean, you can, you know, start off with the beers and drink a different brand of beer, you know, every day for 2.5 years and never drink the same one twice. I stuck with a lot of the American whiskey and vodka, Russian vodka and that kind of stuff. But the thing that I loved the most was Jägermeister. And, you know, and so I would usually include a few shots of Jägermeister just about every night out. And turns out I wasn't a good soldier because I kind of I had this trade of working on these big generators, precise power generators that operate hospitals and and airports. And So when they sent me over there, they put me in a field artillery unit and put me in charge of these five little 5kW generators. And it was like a big joke. What, you know, what am I doing here in a field artillery unit? And then they're threatening to send us over to Vietnam constantly. So it turned out I wasn't a good soldier, and I just started drinking more and more. Fast forward, I was over there for 2.5 years. At the end of that 2.5 years, I developed a habit of drinking just about every day. I never considered myself an alcoholic. My dad was a wounded World War II vet, and he'd gotten blown up, his back broken, he just drank every day of his life, and as far back as I could remember until when he died. I would joke around sometimes about, my dad's cruising through life at a 0.25, he's just always got something going on. He was my idea of what an alcoholic might be. And even in Germany when I was drinking, which seemed to me like daily, it wasn't, I'd drink for, several days, and then I'd, decide, well, I'm going on the wagon, and I'm not going to drink for a while. And while I was over there, there wasn't a big incentive to not drink, so I don't think I made it more than a few days. But when I got back, I was faced with, what do I do now? I had helped out building this big sailboat just south of here down in San Jose during my high school years. It was a friend of mine's brother-in-law that was building. It's a 70-foot, two-masted schooner. So I started hanging out with those guys. They had almost completed the boat, in the 2.5 years that I was gone. Started hanging out with those guys. And I should have went and started putting my application in to try to get a job, at an airport or a hospital or something. But I remember I was drunk one night, and I just told these guys, I go, you know what? I think I want to be a sailor. I go, if I go to work on these generators, they have a lot of power. And so, the way I like to party, somebody's going to get hurt. It's probably going to get me, be me. Where do I sign on? I want to be a crew. This boat. So I just completely walked away from a pretty good career. I probably would have been in retired many years ago if I had followed that career, but I ended up on this sailboat and we're going to sail off to Hawaii. And these guys drank a little bit, but nobody drank like me. So right away, I'm butting heads with people, mainly the captain of the boat, the owner. Because I would just choose the wrong times to get drunk, and started off with my first couple of DUIs, while we were doing that. But we ended up in San Francisco, and we were ready to go to Hawaii. We're just waiting for a new set of sails, and we pulled into Fisherman's Wharf up there. I'd been there when I was a kid. Yeah, but I didn't remember much, and didn't have much effect on me. But I tell you, pulling in there on the sailboat after, spending a couple of days sailing up there from the South Bay, and I really needed a drink. And I had no money left. I'd spent everything that I had when I got out of the Army. So we pull into Fisherman's Wharf, and I walk up the street, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's like there's two or three blocks on every block and, or two or three bars on every block. And people are standing out on the sidewalk, drinking, and it's just a 24-hour party. And all of a sudden the thought of sailing off to Hawaii with these guys I didn't like didn't seem that attractive. I started thinking, wow, I just want to stay here. And so we were doing some day sailing out of there and getting tourists to come sailing with us. The gig was you can come sailing with us, but you buy the booze and bring the food. So we were doing that for a while. And then I met these commercial fishermen, and they went out with us. And we got back in, and they brought a bunch of beer and a bunch of other stuff. But we get back in, they go, hey, you want to go up the bar and have a few drinks? And I said, I'd love to, but I don't have any money. And they said, well, we got plenty of money. Come on, let's go. And so I ended up, going up to the bar with these guys, and they were my people. They had rolls of money in their pocket. They drank like I drank, it was work hard, play hard. And I went from wanting to be a sailor sailing off to Hawaii, to I wanted to be a commercial fisherman. And by this time my hair had grown out, my beard had grown out. And started looking around. It was mostly young, clean-cut Italian kids that were crewing on those boats. And about the time I realized, you know what, nobody's going to hire me. And this old Italian guy came to me, and he found out that I did the electrical work on that sailboat, and he was building a new fishing boat. And so he said, you know what, I hear you, want a job on a fishing boat. I said, I do. And he goes, well, if you come out and you do the electrical work on this new boat I'm building, I've got this other boat over here, you can start fishing with me right away, and I'll teach you how to fish. So I signed on with him. You know, it took us about 9 months to finish that other boat. And I was making, you know, more money than I'd made in a lot of time, long time since I'd got out of the Army, maybe $30-$40 a day on that little boat. But we put that big boat in the water and took off, and we were starting a new fishery. And because I helped him finish it up, I was the top crew member. And so I, you know, my share was 20% of the catch. And we went out the very first day, I made $1,000, you know, and that was more money than I ever dreamed of making. And then it just got better from there. And we started gearing up for 2 and 3 day trips, and we couldn't do it. We would plug the boat in a day and a half, 2 days. And all of a sudden, I'm the guy, you know, with the roll of money in my pocket and buying everybody drinks and food. And, you know, I had arrived, and you know, if I thought that was going to last forever, otherwise I would have saved a little of that money, you know, because it just seemed like, you know, my dreams have all come true. And you know, and it lasted for quite some time, but it eventually did die down. I, you know, through that whole time, I didn't drink on the boat. That was the rule. You don't drink on the boat. But, you know, I would start thinking about drinking, you know, at the end of the trip. And, you know, and those rides in were just torture. And, you know, we get in, you know, a lot of times late at night after the bars were closed. And so I always had to make sure I had something stashed away, you know, where I could have something when we got in. And as the years went on, you know, my behavior started getting worse. I wasn't quite as responsible. I ended up, I was overserved one night. We had come in from a trip and had, you know, a boatload of fish. And I ended up going up to the bar. The bars were still open, and got drunk, came back to the boat. Don't remember any of it. And ended up, I thought I was sleeping in my bunk, but I wasn't. I was in a blackout, and I hear my captain screaming my name, and I kind of come to, and I'm standing over his bunk, and he's in it, and I'm going to the bathroom. And, you know, it's not a good thing to do, you know, go to the bathroom all over your captain if you, you know, want to keep advancing in the fishing industry. And he was screaming bloody murder. He, you know, I thought he kind of overreacted. You know, I told him, you know, this could happen to anybody. And he didn't think that was very funny. You know, I thought, well, you know, it was just over the foot of his bunk. And if it had been over the head of his bunk, I could see him, you know, being upset about it. But he was pretty upset, and I figured he's going to fire me. And he didn't, you know, because I'd been with him for so long. Didn't fire me, but he just kept me around, I think, to humiliate me. And, you know, the next day he's telling everybody, you wouldn't believe what Jim did last night. And I finally was so humiliated, I walked off of that boat, and I remember thinking, you know, how dare him after everything I did for him, you know, and then he, you know, he treats me like that. And, you know, and then I started thinking about the captain of the sailboat, and then I started drinking and thinking, and decided, you know what, I'm going to build my own boat, and it's going to be a sailing fishing boat, and I'm going to catch more fish than either of those guys. I'm going to, you know, it's going to sail faster, and just started making all these promises to myself, you know, about what I'm going to do. And what it was a resentment, and a couple of resentments. And, you know, they talk about alcoholics don't have willpower, and you know, we have plenty of willpower. We just don't have any willpower when it comes to our drinking, because I decided to show them I'm going to build this boat. And, you know, and I darn near did it, you know, over the next, several years. I started building it. I ended up running several other boats and then eventually bought my own fishing boat. And I did good, you know, as long as I could keep it together while I was out fishing, and made a ton of money and was able to build a 60-foot, two-masted sailing fishing schooner, at least 80% of it. And then towards the end of my drinking, I had this 35-foot double ender Monterey that I was actively fishing. It was kind of a sight for sore eyes. It had been built in 1928, but I would just load it up with fish. But as my drinking started to get worse, I went from considering the boat a dry boat. You know, you couldn't bring any booze on the boat, to a dry boat is that the crew cannot bring any booze on the boat. But since I'm the captain, you know, I need a little something, you know, just to kind of take the edge off, because it's hard work. And, you know, and at first I started bringing these little bottles of brandy and not letting the crew know. And then I started buying cases of beer, because I remembered how it was when we get in after a trip and the bars were closed. And I think, well, you know, it'd be nice to have a little beer to give the crew in case that happens. And then, you know, I remembered that my captain, my first captain, the Italian guy, used to always have a gallon of wine under the sink for cooking. And I thought, well, that would be a good idea. And so I started buying gallons of wine and putting them under the sink for cooking. And I use a little bit of it for cooking, but I go out on these 5-10 day trips and there was never anything left when I got in, and I didn't share any of it. And so there I'm not only drinking while I'm out there fishing, I'm leaving to go on these trips when I'm blind drunk and blackouts. Give you an idea of what it was like there at the very end is, I'm coming in, on the, double ender Monterey. You know, if you want to get an idea of what it looked like, there was this movie called Captain Ron that it came out right about that time. And he's got this dilapidated old sailboat and, you know, rust and, boat parts falling off. And in my case, fishing gear hanging all over the place and everything in disarray. 'Cause when I get in, I just drink, wouldn't do any maintenance and everything. And so I'm coming into Fisherman's Wharf there in San Francisco, and it's bright sunny day, which was unusual because we usually did all our traveling at night. You know, we'd leave at night, get to the fishing grounds at daylight, you know, and fish out the day. You sometimes drift offshore at night or find an anchorage or, you know, and we'd fish for however many days, 3, 4, 5 days, and end the fishing at dark, and then 8 or 10 hour ride to get back into Fisherman's Wharf and end up in the wee hours in the morning or middle of the night. And but this particular trip, we're coming in midday, and which was strange, and the only thing I can figure to this day was we just loaded up the boat early and ended the trip early. And as I'm coming into the heart of Fisherman's Wharf, you know, these old boats, you got to keep your speed up so you have steerage. You know, if you go too slow, you know, and you turn your wheel, they don't turn. And it's kind of a little tight maneuver to get into the fish dock where I sold my fish. And so I come around the first corner and I give it a little gas just to kick the stern to make the turn. And I look up and there's all these tourists up on the sidewalk, and they're all looking at me, you know, and what they see is this dilapidated old fishing boat, you know, speeding up and heading straight for the dock, you know, and their eyes are all bugging out. And I know what they're thinking. You know, I just saw that movie, Captain Ron, you know, they're thinking I'm going to run right into that dock, you know? And so I start to make my next turn to turn into the dock, and I got to give it a little more gas, you know, so I can kick the stern around. And then I'm really moving, and then I throw it in reverse. Reverse is the brake, and I put it in reverse and bring it to a stop, and I lay up along the edge of that dock just perfect. You know, I could have had an egg between the boat and the dock and not cracked it, you know. And I don't know who was driving that boat and Captain Ron. Whoever it was, they did it perfect. I did it perfect. Kurt Russell stepped off that boat and said, you know, where's the party, or give me a cold one or something. I forget what it was that he said, and that's what I wanted to say, you know, but I didn't think that would look good, you know, when, in front of my crew. And it was a perfect high tide, you know, I stepped off the boat straight onto the dock, and I said, you know what, guys, the weather's good. We're going to make a turnaround. We're going to go load the boat up again. I want you to get the fish off the boat, get the old ice off the boat, get some new ice on, some new bait. I'll be back in about 5 minutes to help you guys out. And I had every intention in the world of coming back and helping those guys out, but I needed a drink. You know, we'd been out for several days. I don't know how long it had been since I'd run out of the booze on the boat. And I go up to the bar, and I did what I always do. I'm only going to have a couple. And so I order a drink, and then I order another one. And, you know, on about the second drink, I start, you know, getting thirsty. And I'd never heard anything like the phenomenon of craving. You know, I'd never been to AA. Nobody ever described that phenomenon of craving to me. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and they started to talk about the phenomenon of craving, I identified right away because of this story and so many other stories. And what happened is I had those couple of drinks, and then I thought, you know what? There's not a big difference between two and three drinks. You know, bartender, give me another one. And so I get another one, and then another one. And then about that time, I start thinking, you know what? I'm the captain of this darn boat. I pay those guys well. I deserve to sit up here and relax and have a few drinks. You know, I should let them earn their money. Bartender, give me another one. And then I drink myself into either oblivion or a blackout. And I'm married by this time. I have a baby girl at home. You know, I have no business being in a bar, spending money I should be spending on diapers and milk. But by this point in my drinking, that's what I do. The other thing I do is about the time I start seeing double, I start feeling single. And so I start talking with the girls. And the drunker I get, the better my boat starts looking. And I start describing my gorgeous fishing boat down here at the dock. You know, just came in with a big load of fish. And, you know, why don't you come down and check out my boat? And I don't know how I did it, you know, but I talked these two girls into coming down and checking out my boat. And so we leave the bar and we're walking back down to the fish dock. And I have no idea how long I've been in there drinking. But about every 5 or 6 hours around the San Francisco Bay Area, the tide goes up and down, sometimes 6 or 7 feet. And so when I put everything together later, I figured I was in that bar drinking for about 5 or 6 hours, because as I'm walking down to the dock, instead of watching where I'm going, I'm, you know, turning around, I'm looking at these girls, you know, telling them some fishing stories, and, you know, start to describe my boat. And here's my boat right here. And for that one moment, I was Captain Ron again. You know, I'm going to step right back onto that boat as cool as I stepped off of it, which seemed like a short time ago. And I go to take that step, and the boat was no longer there. It was down about 7 feet. I basically just walked off the end of the dock, and I gathered my thoughts on the way down. My feet hit the rail, but there was ice all over the rail from the guys shoveling the old ice overboard, and they slipped off, and I came down. I landed on my ribs, and I knew I was hurt. I busted a couple of ribs, and I'm laying there on the edge of that rail, my feet dangling in the water. One of the girls said, "Are you all right?" And I, you know, I don't like looking bad. So I told him, "Of course I'm all right. I can't show you the boat right now. It's a little slippery." And, you know, and when I went up there to have those couple of drinks to, you know, take the edge off, you know, I didn't plan on any of that happening. You know, I ended up, pulling myself up onto the boat. I crawled over the ladder. I climbed back up the ladder. I got these girls, you know, around me, the guys that worked at the fish dock, my crew, everybody saying, you know what, you're hurt. You need to get to the hospital. And I knew I was hurt and I needed to get to the hospital. But I knew I needed one for the road. And I ended up going back in that bar to have that one for the road. And next thing I know, I come out of a blackout, felt like my ribs are going to pop through my side. I'm in my bunk on the boat. The boat's rocking and rolling. It turns out we're about 4 hours offshore. I'm screaming at my crew, "What are you doing? You're trying to kill me. I need to be in a hospital." And they said, "Jim, we tried to talk you out of it, but you wouldn't listen. You threw the lines off. You know, you took the boat out for, you know, for the first couple hours." And, so that's what happens when I drink, you know. I said I had no booze left on the boat, had no groceries, no nothing, and had the bait. The guys got the bait on the boat. But, so they turned the boat around, and we headed back in, and got back in, and I went straight back to the bar. Never did go to the doctor. Those ribs hurt for years after that, even right on into sobriety. And, you know, so that's how my drinking is. And, you know, I don't know how many stories like that where I just did a lot of stupid stuff. You know, I, when I was a kid, I used to have this fear of getting beat up. And once I discovered alcohol, you know, no more fear, you know, and, you know, I would start fights in bars, and I was never a very good fighter. About the time I got the nerve to fight, you know, I couldn't hardly stand on 2 feet. You know, I got beaten pretty badly many a times. And, you know, I developed the reputation of a guy that can really take a beating. And, you know, and that's what my life was like. And I eventually came back from one of those supposedly fishing trips, but more drinking than fishing, and went home. My wife had just lost her sense of humor, said she wanted out of this relationship. I was starting to have some health problems. I was having back problems from a car accident in Germany that was catching up with me. I was having money problems. You know, things were starting to look pretty grim. And in the back of my mind, I thought, you know, if things just get to where I cannot work any longer, my wife will take care of me. And so I go home and she is done. You know, she says, I want out of this relationship. I want a divorce. You know, and at first I said, what, you know, why would you want to divorce a nice guy like me? And she goes, cause you know, you don't love me. You're never here. All you care about is your drinking and your fishing buddies and in the boat. She says, I just want out of this relationship. And I would have been better off if I had just left it at that and said, fine, I'll give you a divorce, but, you know, leave it to an alcoholic to, you know, dig a little deeper and a little deeper hole to fall into, because that's what I did. I said, you know, that's ridiculous. You know, that can't be the reason you want a divorce. What's the real reason? And she goes, you want the real reason? And the way she looked at me when she said that, I just really regretted asking her what the real reason was. And she goes, I'm going to tell you what the real reason is. She goes, I'm in love with another man. I have been for quite some time. I just want out of this relationship. Would you please just leave? And I was crushed. She was two-timing me. It was okay when I was doing it, but when it's happening to me, that's not right. And I walked out of my own home with my tail between my legs, thinking, what am I gonna do? And you know, and I go back up to Fisherman's Wharf and I start drinking and thinking. And a man that was to become my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous early on, he's speaking at this meeting. I'm sitting in the front row still shaking it off. And he goes, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, we know two things about you. And I thought, what do you know? He just got through describing how he crawled out of St. James Park. He was an old wino, you know, and he goes, one, you haven't had a good year. And I thought, well, yeah, I'll give you that one. And he goes, two, you probably have a plan. And I thought, yeah, I got a plan and I'm not telling you and I'm not telling anybody. And, what my plan was, I came up with it in my, last run of drinking that I have no idea how long it was, a couple of weeks, probably. And I, was sitting at the bar drinking and thinking. And, you know, and he would always say, you know, never drink and think at the same time. It's bad news for an alcoholic because you always come up with a bad plan. And I did. And I was sitting there drinking and thinking and I decided, you know what? I'm done. I'm just, you know, everything has just turned bad. Everything I try, you know, I'm a failure. I'm just done. And, you know, I can't believe what she's done to me. I think I'm just going to go kill her boyfriend in front of her to show her you don't mess with a guy like me. And then I'll jump off the Golden Gate Bridge. And I felt better as soon as I came up with that plan. There's an end to my pain, you know, bartender, give me another one. And, so I ended up confiding in a friend of mine, a guy that had fished with me many years before, big Irishman and about a head or two taller than me. And it's a wonder he never killed me in the years he fished for me. But I confided in him about my plan and he wasn't going to tell anybody. But before I know it, I'm sitting in the VA, Vietnam Vets Mental Health Center, 50 miles south of San Francisco. They got me in a little room and there, he had, got me to go down there. He told me they were going to give me some dope to help me feel better. And he told everybody, and all of a sudden I realized I'm locked up in a nut house. And I learned something that day. You don't have to be crazy to get locked up in a nut house. All you got to do is get enough people thinking you're crazy, say a few crazy things, act a little crazy, and they lock you up. And so that's what they did to me. And it was the worst day of my life. Things were bad, but at least I was in the bar drinking, and now I'm locked in this little room. I can't believe it. But what happened is it turned out to be the best day of my life, because after several people coming in and talking with me, there was a little old lady, somebody's grandma. She was from state rehabilitation and wasn't even part of the mental health center. And she started talking to me about alcoholism and asked me if I was an alcoholic. And I told her the whole spiel. No, I'm not an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. I know what an alcoholic is. I don't drink like an alcoholic. When I drink like an alcoholic, but I can quit drinking anytime I want. I've done it a million times. And she just had that look of compassion. And then she started talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I told her, I can't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an alcoholic. And she says, you don't have to. She says, you don't have to be an alcoholic. She goes, if you go, maybe you'll hear something that'll help you feel better. And that was the magic words and the look in her eye when she said that. And it was enough when they finally let me out. I went to an AA meeting, and it turns out I like AA. From the very beginning, I liked AA. I love the stories. It was like everybody's got a different story. It reminded me, the room was kind of dim and grim, but other than that, the people and the excitement and the camaraderie, and everybody talking, nobody listening. It was like the bars and my many attempts to stop drinking. That was the hardest part. Oh, I'm not going to drink. I can't go to the bar. And I get to feeling so lonely I could die. I thought I was going to die of loneliness. But all of a sudden I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, before I've done any steps or got a sponsor or anything, something's happening. And what it was is I started to develop a little bit of hope. And that man that was talking that day, and he continued to make fun of me. All of a sudden I'm a few days without booze, and all this fear of getting beat up just came back like a ton of bricks. The fear of people came back like a ton of bricks. And so, I was able to muster up enough courage to ask this guy to sponsor me, which I thought was a big mistake, but it turned out to be a good one. He's a big guy, old truck driver, and motives do not matter. He started telling me, do this, do that. And I thought, I'm not going to do that. That's stupid, but then I thought, well, if I don't do it, he's going to hurt me. And so I would at least try. He made me a greeter at this big meeting. And I said, I can't be a greeter. And he said, why? And I go, I don't like people. And he says, I don't care. Get over there. And I thought, he's going to hit me. So I got over and felt like I had locked jaw and a frozen elbow trying to greet these people. It was painful. But as it's all happening, something's happening inside of me. I'm starting to gain more and more hope that, maybe there is something here. Maybe I am an alcoholic. Maybe that's my problem. Maybe what has happened to you guys will happen to me. I loved your reading, it's like, in the preface of the big book at the end of that, something about reading one of the stories in the back of the book, you'll find yourself saying, I felt like that, or that's happened to me, or maybe this will work for me too, or something like that. I've never been very good at quoting the book, but that's what I found myself saying to myself, the longer I stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous. He made me start greeting these people, and it was so painful. I just can't do it, and he saw me struggling one night, and he comes over and he goes, Jim, have you ever once thought that one of these guys walking into this meeting is a little more uncomfortable than you are? And I said, no, because I hadn't, I'm just thinking about how uncomfortable I am. And he goes, I want you to think about that. And the next guy that walks in, and he looks like he's not having a good day, you try to help him feel a little more comfortable and welcome to this meeting. And I did. All of a sudden, I started seeing those guys. And that night, everything changed because I went home and I just had this feeling that, you know what, I'm okay. You know, I think I was experiencing peace and serenity for the first time ever in my life without a bunch of booze on board. And, you know, and so that was a turning point for me. You know, all of a sudden, you know, when there was a commitment, you know, I'll do it, you know, and I just jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous with both feet, you know, started, into the steps, you know, the fifth step because, you know, I was such a rotten father and husband and employer for so many years. I mean, you know, when I wrote my inventory and did my fifth step, it was a big weight off of my back. And, you know, and going back and making amends, you know, there were some amends that I knew I was never going to be able to make. There were some amends that I knew that I just would never make because, you know, they don't deserve it. You know, but over time, you know, I think my heart just softened up and it got to the point where I just wanted to clean up the wreckage of my past. That boat I built sat there for 5 years without me doing any work on it. The shipyard that I was building it at, I owed them a ton of money. I owed the gear store a bunch of money, the fuel dock, everybody. And they're hounded me, the IRS. And one day my sponsor, when I'm complaining, and he says, yeah, I go, you know, they're after me for my money. You know, I don't have any money, but they're after me for my money. And he goes, no, they're not, because they don't want your money. And I felt better for about a minute. He says, they want their money. And, but, you know, early on, I told him I will never sell that boat because he suggested, since that's the only thing I have worth anything. And I said, I will never sell that boat, but I was about a year sober and I just wanted to clean up that wreckage. And so I decided to sell it and I sold it for pennies on the dollar, watched another man finish it, sail it halfway around the world and back. Talk about resentments. You know, if I had a way to call him up and say, you know how drunk I was when I put that haul together? See how that'd make him feel out there in a hurricane. They trucked it across the United States, put it on a ship, shipped it to France, and then he spent 5 years sailing around Europe and then eventually sailed her back across the Atlantic and spent a year on the East Coast and then down through the Bahamas and the Panama Canal back up the West Coast. And, you know, he's living out my dream, you know, and there was times where I was just really upset about it. You know, and I'm, you know, getting a little sobriety. Sometimes my prayers would be, God, you know, why did you give me all these talents to commercial fish, to sail, to navigate, if you're going to make me a land lover? And then one day that thought crossed my mind. And I realized that a couple of days before that, I was working with a new guy. We're talking about the steps and his eyes were starting to glaze over. And I did what I'd done many times before. I just went into a fishing story, you know, got his attention back. And then we went back to the steps. And so that day I'm thinking, oh, well, maybe that's why I had all those experiences, you know, was so I could have some stories to tell these guys and help them out and help them with, you know, to get some sobriety. And, you know, and I just had that feeling, you know what, that's okay. You know, that's good. If I never step foot on a boat the rest of my life, that's okay. And I didn't. I didn't step foot on a boat of any kind for almost 20 years. And so, you know, long story short, I, you know, being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I was able to be a good dad. I was able to be a good ex-husband. You know, I had to go through all the stuff with not a pleasant divorce, but I did it. And, you know, and I did it like a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My ex-wife, who hated me, you know, she didn't play fair at the beginning. But I had a sponsor that made me play fair. And when I was about 5 years sober, she was giving me the strangest looks. And I thought they were looks of hate. But, you know, later she told me she couldn't believe that I had gone so long without drinking. And she ended up coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. She just celebrated 23 years of sobriety. And, you know, and our daughter that we turned out to be good parents, you know, raising our daughter, You know, she was 4 when I got sober, and she got sober at 19 years old. And her pitch is, you know, I started going to AA meetings when I was 4 years old, and I didn't get sober till I was 19. So that ought to tell you that just going to AA meetings is not enough. And she just moved out. She's buying a house today in Virginia Beach out there. And she's 31 years old now. And she kind of slowed down on the AA, but I have some high hopes. And she still loves her sobriety. She still talks to all her sponsees out here. And so there's hope there. And I ended up hearing a girl speak. She was our general service rep in out here in California, Northern California, and she had just a level of enthusiasm that was just, you know, really pleasing. And I hadn't done too well in the dating game. You know, I no booze on board. Women scare me, you know, and had a couple of failed relationships. I learned a lot, but they didn't work out. And I was just starting to think, you know, I'm going to be single the rest of my life. And that's okay. You know, I've got a good life. You know, I love AA, love everything that I do. A new career, you know, things were good. And then I hear this girl speak, and she's doing her delegates report, and you know, and there was something attractive about it. And my home group didn't have an alternate GSR, and so I thought, well, maybe I'll volunteer, be the alternate GSR, and then I can, you know, go to some of these general service things, and maybe I'll run into this gal and get to know her a little bit. And, so I did, you know, I was the AA stalker, general service stalker. And, you know, one thing led to another. We ran into each other on the streets of San Francisco. She was doing an area, report at, one of the, districts. And I was secretary in a big meeting, right there in, the Tenderloin, that I used to visit quite often in my drinking years, and one of the greatest secretaryships I think I'd ever done. And so we started talking, exchanged numbers, and started dating. And a year later, we were getting married, had the AA wedding, 200 of our best friends, you know. And I never in my wildest dreams dreamt that, you know, that could happen. And you know, we went from living in a little mobile home to buying a little house on a hill, and we wanted to get closer to her work. And, you know, so we ended up with a really nice home. We thought, well, we'll never be able to pay for it, but maybe if we make it an AA home, God will let us keep it, you know. And so she sponsors a fair amount of gals, and I sponsor a fair amount of guys, and we just, you know, made it an AA home. And, you know, having meetings here and you know, meeting with our sponsees, and it's been a little different now with COVID. There's a few people that we've made exceptions and brought in, but you know, life was good. Can't get any better. You know, our AA life is good. Even with the COVID, life is good. But prior to the COVID, about 4 years ago, I'm looking on Craigslist, and I'm looking for a locker to stow our sound equipment for our home group. And our home group, by the way, you're all invited. It's a Saturday night speaker meeting. Right now we're running about 180 people on Zoom, but when we were meeting in person, we were about 300 to 350 people every week. And so a fun meeting. So I'm looking on Craigslist for some metal military lockers, because I thought they would be good for our sound equipment. And the first thing that pops up is that boat I built. And I'd kind of lost track of it, you know, over the last few years. I knew it made it back to California. In fact, Sharon and I went and looked at it one day, and the guy was wanting to sell it, but it was, you know, way out of our range. But it pops up on Craigslist, you know, I'm looking for that locker. And I looked at over that ad over and over and over again, had nothing in there about military metal locker. You know, why that boat popped up first thing, I don't know. And so anyway, the price was about half of what the guy was asking for it a couple of years prior. So I called him up, you know, and make arrangements to go look at it. She was in pretty sorry shape. You know, she hadn't had any maintenance in a long time. And, you know, so my wife wife and I talked about, well, should we try to buy her back and restore and get her up and running? You know, it was a dream for a long time, and decided, no, it's, you know, a lot of money. And guy kept lowering the price, lower and lower and lower. And finally I said, you know, somebody's going to buy it. When you do, if you want to pass my information along, I'd love to help the new owners out. And, you know, if they want to know the early construction and stuff. So about a month later, I get a phone call, and it's a young couple that had bought it, and they asked if I would help them. And so I started mentoring them to restore her. And I had some ulterior motives. I just want to ride on it. You know, I'd put a lot of money and a lot of time and never even got to go for a ride. And so I started helping them out, and I realized right away that they, you know, they're kind of in over their heads. But, with my help and some other people's help, you know, we can, help them to succeed with it. And they ended up calling me in the middle of the night. I thought I was a newcomer, and it was the wife, and she's hysteric. They had tried to move the boat on her own, and 60 feet long, weighs 30 tons, you know, big boat, and they ended up hitting the dock, and the first thing out of her mouth is, oh, we are in so much trouble. We tried to move the boat, we hit the dock, we messed up the boat, we messed up the dock, we're in over our heads. And right before that, when my wife and I were talking what we would spend for that boat, my wife says, well, I think free would be good. And I said, yeah, right. And, if God wants to have it, we'll get it for free. And so we didn't think much more about it. But the next thing out of this gal's mouth is, we just want out. You know, we're in over our heads. You built that boat. We think that boat belongs to you. We want you to have it. We just want to give it to you. And when I said that, Sharon wakes up out of a dead sleep. And so we started talking with them. I tried to talk them out of it. You know, it was more than I really wanted to bite off, but they they just wanted out. We ended up giving them a little money to help them recoup their money. And we went to work on her, and we decided to make her an AA boat. And, up until COVID, we had taken out in groups of 6, 8, and 10 over 200 of our friends in Alcoholics Anonymous for sales on the bay. You know, my favorite thing is newcomers, get them out there underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. And most of them have never driven across that bridge, let alone be underneath it, you know. And every time, you know, I mean, it's a spiritual moment for me because, you know, that was where I was headed and looking up and there's me and the newcomers, and we're looking up and we're all going, in this Bay Area, it's just gorgeous from a boat, you know, San Francisco. And I do the prison cruise, Alcatraz, San Quentin, we got her back. She's up and running. She's ready to sail just about anywhere. You know, we're going to do some sailing up to the Pacific Northwest, and then who knows, maybe eventually out to the East Coast where our daughter is. But, you know, none of this would have happened without Alcoholics Anonymous. And if I had tried to have planned any of this out, there's no way that I would have succeeded, you know. And it's been, you know, having this relationship with God and constantly trying to improve this relationship with God. I'm not really good at meditation and prayer, you know. Most of the time it's just like sitting here talking with you. But, you know, I feel this peace in my heart. You know, my mind is quiet. And the biggest thing is that I have this sense of purpose. And I never had that drink, and I thought I did, money, property, and prestige, but it was never enough. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, those three things that, you know, this program has given me, I wouldn't trade them for anything in the world. So with that, I thank you all for listening. I love your group, and thank you much.